Danilana Kitchen talks about food. Danilana Kitchen talks recipes. Danilana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio.
The Danilana Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community. More information can be found at www.themuckyduckpub.com or from Marcus at telephone number 232-8888.
Welcome to the Danilana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctical.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here once a week to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. This is KHOI Community Radio. They let us on the air here, and we have a fine job, fine time doing it, too. So, Donna, did you successfully navigate daylight saving time?
I did. And here's how I do it. My car, the clock in my car, it's just annoying to change the time on it. So it is permanently on daylight savings time. So every time I'm in the car, I'm very aware that, you know, if there is a time thing in it, because you have to factor it in and think about it. So now my car is on the same time as everybody else in town.
Good.
Did you oversleep yourself?
No. We are all in sync. For some reason, I remembered this year. And
We're in such a no man's land with time right now anyway.
That's true.
I've lately been getting up with the sunrise to hear the birds sing. Oh, I think I saw the fat robins yesterday.
Oh, maybe. They're back.
It was a quick thing and then a bunch of them flew off. So that's probably... Was it you that told me that fat robins, because they are a little bigger, it's a group of robins that come earlier than everybody else?
I didn't know about that.
I think we talked about it on the radio, and it's called fat robins. Who would have told me? They did seem a little bigger than your normal robins.
Like the storm troops, the people.
They go in first, right?
Oh, good.
Right, and they are more flockish than robins normally are.
That's a good term there. Yeah. I like flockish. Good. So spring is here, and so I did a lot of, over the weekend, let you know, I did a lot of pitchfork chores around the farm. I cleaned out the chicken house, moved a lot of hay for the sheep, cleaned out the sheep bedding. And so I employed what I learned. A couple Danilana Kitchen shows ago, we reviewed a book called, bear with me here. It's called Holy S... Managing Manure to Save Mankind by Gene Logsdon, and he talks a lot about how to successfully use a pitchfork, and I did, by golly. Yes, I did.
So you didn't strain yourself
because
you did the proper posture.
No, that and compare, and always when I do something like that, time for a bubble bath. I think the idea of working hard and a real long, everything is fine on the farm. Good. Well, I want to talk for a minute about we have a whole lot of things to get through today. First, going through my freezer, I found this wonderful little package of stuff, and I made myself a good supper last week. I came across a little package and it said, from Kenny, doves, it said, doves. What the heck am I going to,
that's something I don't have in my freezer.
Four little doves, and they were all nicely cleaned. They look like
the whole body
freeze dried chickens, but they're only about six or eight inches long. I have had doves before, but long time ago. So how do you cook a dove? I don't know. So I decided,
like a tiny, tiny chicken.
They were small enough that the first thing I did was take them out of their wrapper and clean, make sure that their little cavity was cleaned out well by sticking my thumb in there. And as I did that, I thought, this is just the size of a dried apricot. So I put a dried apricot in every little cavity, put them on some cut up celery to keep them up off the ground in a little Pyrex pan. And I had some squash in the oven. And so I cooked them drizzled some olive oil on.
I was going to say, probably like most game, they're quite lean.
They're quite lean, so you got to kind of have to be careful there. So I put them in an oven, 350, 375, something like that, and just watched them really well. And once they started to brown a little bit on top, and they were small, so it didn't take long at all, I made a marmalade. I had some kumquat marmalade, and I made some kumquat marmalade, put a little extra water, actually.
A little glaze.
So it's kind of like this little soggy jelly thing, and I put that on top.
Fancy. Oh,
did that ever turn out good? Anyway, doves, what a nice thing. Okay, so I finished the meal here, and I end up with these tiny, tiny little bones, and I thought, so what's the difference between a dove and a pigeon? And I've heard of something called squab, too. And who better to ask? I asked Kenny McCabe, who gave me the doves in the first place, and I sent him off a question, and
now,
he got back
to me. Is he the bow
me.
Hunter?
He's a bow hunter. He does all kinds of things. So, and he was recently...
Did he catch the pigeons with the bow?
Oh, good heavens. There wouldn't be nothing left. No, he's a gun hunter, too. He was a gun hunter. It must have been sort of small shot because it was a tiny little shot in one of them. I asked him, so what's the difference, Kenny, between doves, pigeons, and what is a squab? And here is what he wrote back. Doves and pigeons are in the same genus, just different species. Another name for pigeons we see around here are rock doves. Mourning doves, which is the kind that he hunted for me. Mourning doves are a migrating native species and can be hunted in the fall. And rock doves, pigeons are an introduced species that can be hunted any time of year. And as for squab, get this. This is basically a young dove taken from the nest before it flies.
Oh, it must be tiny.
Oh, gosh. So he says, think of veal in the beef world. He says, I've never had it, but I've heard it can be good. So doves, pigeons, squab.
Just in case you need to know.
What we have on our agenda today, we're looking forward to tomorrow. Tomorrow is St. Patrick's Day. Yes, it is here. Think green, think spring is coming. And Donna, we've got some Irish recipes to talk about.
Oh yeah. Okay, so when I think Irish recipes, I have this wonderful book called The Forgotten Skills of Cooking. And this is by a chef called Darina Allen, D-A-R-I-N-A-A-L-L-E-N. And she is referred to as the Julia Child of Ireland, right? So this is a beautiful book. She's also a wonderful writer. She runs something in Ireland called the Ballymallow Cooking School, which is one of those spots that all, you know, it's worth a pilgrimage to that I have always wanted to but never been able to do. But reading the book takes you quite there. So, I mean, and it's a heavy book. It's like 700 recipes, right? So I thought, well, how can I even begin this? So I thought, all right, I'm going to pick something that traditionally Americans eat, which is not, what's the potatoes and, was it brisket?
Cabbage.
Corned beef cabbage, right? I know. I wasn't going to do that one. But soda bread is something you will see. Like right now, all the supermarkets in town have big displays of Irish cheeses and things like that. And what is the best thing to go with an Irish cheese or some really good butter, but an Irish soda bread? So I looked at her recipes, and she has three or four in them with various, you know, stories about them and options and all of that sort of thing. So this morning I whipped one up, and I have to say, we do have an Irish soda bread recipe on our web page of recipes. So I will just tell you slight variations that I made in her soda bread. Now, the nice thing about soda bread is it's really quick. I mean, I don't think it took me more than 7 minutes to mix the whole thing up, and then a half an hour in the oven.
Now, this doesn't have yeast, folks. You're not going to go through all that magic. No. It's really, think of biscuits, but because it has a little bit more care and kneading, it has a
But not
nicer.
Much.
Not much. But not it, much. It's nicer. It's pretty.
Yeah. So she starts this. I'm going to read a couple things that she says in here. Her first recipe is Mummy's brown soda bread. In our household of 9 children, Mummy made this bread virtually every day of her life, well into her 80s. She always had a light hand at baking. Whenever we were, her bread was one of the things we looked forward to when we came home for a few days. She made many happy memories at the table. So then later in the book, she does several variations on the soda bread. The basic thing is that it has, she's calling it buttermilk. But she says a note about buttermilk, and I found this right interesting. In Ireland, shop-bought buttermilk tends to be very thin and low in fat. So Mummy often added a little sour cream or a scraping of butter from a butter wrapper to enrich the bread. This results in a more crumbly texture. Often buttermilk is thicker and much more the consistency of yogurt. If using this kind of buttermilk, which is mostly what we have here, you'll need to use more of it than specified in this recipe. If the dough is too dry, the bread will be heavy and close textured. So she also says you can use other types of cow's milk and things and just to add a little souring, you know, or something like that. So I used the kefir that I always have going in my refrigerator. And it worked really, really well. And I made this version called the Spotted Dog Railway Cake.
Oh, that's nice.
Nice name, right? I just made it because of the name. I thought, okay. It's basically a version that has raisins in it, which you'll see a lot if you buy your soda bread. But here's the thing about soda bread. It is best eaten the day that it's baked. And I started it really early this morning and I just couldn't, I dove into it and had 3 pieces before I even thought about what I was doing. It was so good.
Thank you for saving some for me.
Yes, oh, right. Well, it's a full loaf, you know, but it's very good toasted. So, we did re-toast it up and I put a little surprise in it. So here's what she says. So you can use either whole wheat flour or pastry flour. And as she says in her book that white flour used to be more expensive. So it was considered a luxury to have white flour. These days, white flour is actually probably cheaper here anyway. So I used a mix of unbleached white and whole wheat. Pastry flour, not whole wheat bread flour, which you probably could use some in this, but it's basically 3.5 cups of flour and then 1 teaspoon of baking soda, because that's the leavening, and 1 teaspoon of salt, 2 teaspoons of sugar. So it's not really a sweet bread, okay? And then I put in quite a lot of raisins. I think I put, it says 2/3, but I probably put more. And then you mix all the dry ingredients and the fruit together just with your fingers, you know, till they're kind of well integrated. And then you, in another bowl, you mix 1 egg and 1 1/3 cups of buttermilk or kefir, right? So you mix the egg and the buttermilk, then you drop it into the bowl with the dry ingredients. You mix it with your fingers. She describes the, this mix well by lifting the flour and fruit up. Let's see. This adds more air. Then you put the egg in. Then you mix together using 1 hand with the fingers open and stiff. Mix in a full circle, drawing in the flour mixture from the sides of the bowl. Just like that.
Good.
The trick, she says, is to not over mix it. Do not handle the dough very much. Then once it's, incorporated, it goes really fast. Really easy. Any fool could do this, I have to tell you. Then you spread a little flour out on the board. You dump the dough onto the floured board. Then you wash your hands and dry them so they won't continue to stick to the dough. And then just shape it into a round loaf. You really don't need it. You don't do anything. Then I did another little trick, which she suggested.
put it in.
Several tricks, right? Okay. Let's go back to mixing into the dry ingredients. Excuse me. This was the variation. Caraway seeds with raisins, right? Not sweet. Now, I am not a huge lover of caraway seeds, especially, you know, you think rye bread immediately. But I thought, yeah, this sounds sort of interesting because here's what she wrote about. She calls this the variation the American soda bread. Caraway seeds and raisins were added to soda bread in Ireland long ago, but the tradition went by the wayside. Not so in America, where soda bread often has caraway seeds and raisins in it. Usually when I go to the U.S., I take Irish recipes there, but I was delighted to bring this one back to Ireland. And then she says, you know, simply add scant teaspoons, I might add, to the spotted dog railway cake, which is what I did. Now, the really nice thing about this is it's not enough caraway seeds that there's some in every bite. It's like you'll be eating along and you get the raisins, which you expect, and because you can see them. And then all of a sudden, there's this little note of caraway. What did you think about that, Lana?
I like caraway. And it was...
I made her guess what it was.
Oh, it was so good. And yes, the idea of having it slightly warm, you got to eat this all up right away. It's really good. And it is... easy. I like making yeast bread too, but this is quick and good.
Now the other thing, one more trick. And this one is optional. I have a deep, well, Joe says it's called a chicken fryer, a very deep cast iron skillet that has a domed lid on it. So I bake the bread in that, which keeps, when you're baking bread in the oven, it actually keeps the moisture in. Mm-hmm. And so you throw it all in the oven you set the oven at 425 and then you turn it down to 400 and it's only a half an hour to bake this whole big loaf. It's really, really beautiful. Now, once you've got it in the pan ready to bake, you do this little thing. And I'm going to read from Dorina Allen one more time because this is really cute. Cut a deep cross into the bread. This is called blessing the bread. And then prick it at the center of each of the four sections to, quote, let the fairies out.
There you should.
Yeah. And the reason for that is, then it comes out baked with this cross in it. It's really quite attractive. And that is because it's a, you know, it's a soggy quick bread. That does help it cook more thoroughly through. So other thing that she wrote about, I hope I haven't lost my place. What's that pot called? Bastable.
A bastable.
She talks about, on the next page after the soda bread, she talks about, I learned to cook over an open fire from my great aunt in Tipperary in the summer holidays throughout the 50s. All of the cooking was done in the big fireplace. She says that basically before the 1950s, most country homes did not have an oven. They all cooked on a wood fire. So a bastable is an iron pot, usually with three little legs underneath it and a slightly domed lid. This is what reminded me of my cast iron. So my cast iron skillet is not a bastable because it's doesn't have the legs on it, right? Mm-hmm. So I just like the word bastable.
Isn't it nice?
It's a nice word. So something else very Irish. And I have to tell you, this bread is it's easier than making scones. It's easier than making biscuits. It's quick. It's also unlike biscuits and scones, which require more either lard or butter or something. The Irish soda bread has very little, or well, mine had none, just the fat from the kefir in it, which is not a lot. Now, our Irish soda bread recipe that is on the website is pretty similar. It has 4 cups of flour instead of 3.5. It's still a teaspoon of salt and 3 teaspoons of baking powder. Aha, different. Oh, mine had no baking powder, only a teaspoon of soda. Mm-hmm. Okay. A 1/4 cup of sugar Lana has here, but mine had much less, 2 tablespoons of sugar, This recipe has cardamom, but instead I put the caraway, and then 1 3/4 cups of milk, and buttermilk, and 1 egg, and a cup of dried currants. So that is fairly similar. So you could try the recipe on our website if you are interested. Yeah. And it's a wonderful thing to make for breakfast because it's very quick and it makes the whole house smell really nice.
Two good reasons to
right.
do that.
So tomorrow morning, your Irish breakfast.
There you go.
With lots of butter, or the picture in Dorena Allen's cookbook shows it with a big wedge of cheese.
That would be good too.
Yes.
So to find out more about the Donald in the Kitchen and to find our recipe page, you can go to khoifm.org. That takes you to this wonderful community radio station. Look for the talk shows. Look for the Donald in the Kitchen. And we've got recipes there. And to keep in a theme here, I would like to play a bit of music. But this music starts out with a reading, an Irish poem by William Butler Yeats. And this is from a concert given by the Barn Owl Band many, many years ago. And the person reading this wonderful poem that leads into the wonderful music is Roger Alexander, a Barn Owl Band musician. And let's hear this wonderful poem. It's called The Fiddler of Dooney.
When I play on my fiddle in Dooney, folk dance like a wave of the sea. My cousin was priest in Kilvarnet, my brother in Mochrabui. I passed my brother and cousin, they read in their books of prayer. I read in my book of songs I bought at the Sligo Fair. When we come at the end of time to Peter sitting in state, he will smile on the three old spirits, but call me first through the gate. For the good are always the merry, save by an evil chance, and the merry love the fiddle, and the merry love to dance. And when the folk there spy me, they'll all come up to me with, "Here's the fiddler of Dooney," and dance like a wave of the sea.
Listening to KHOI, and this is the Donald in the Kitchen Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. That was some music from the Ames-based, Central Iowa-based band, the Barn Owl Band. And I cannot wait to get back on the dance floor soon. Let's work on that, folks. We can do that. Let's think about some thoughts of spring here. Both Donna and I are thinking of the garden, and we're trying new things this year. Donna, what do you have in mind?
Well, I'm doing the same old things, but I have some new varieties.
Oh, yes.
Right. I mean, I mostly do herbs and edible flowers and a lot of other flowers. I don't try to grow vegetables because Lana is so good at that. Plus, I don't have a lot of sun in my in-town yard with all the trees. So I did order, I love nasturtiums. I'm going to try to do lots more nasturtiums this year. So I got some new varieties, which means they're different colors. And the most exciting thing I have, and Lana is starting the seeds for me, is some anise hyssop. Now, I have been growing anise hyssop for a few years, and I'll talk about the uses for it. It's very beautiful. But I ordered two new varieties from, what's it called, Baker Creek, right? So a Korean green hyssop, which is going to be 4 feet tall.
Well, we're looking forward to that.
Yeah. So I'm going to put it sort of at the back of the garden, you know, so that it's, you're supposed to put the tall things in the back, right? Okay. So I got that one. And then another one, which is called a Korean Golden Jubilee anise hyssop. So the thing about anise hyssop is they have these tall, purple, spiky flowers, and the bees love them, and the hummingbirds too. So, and they do this thing, they do self-seed. So they kind of pop up a different place every year in your garden. You never quite know where they're going to show up. So, I mean, we are starting some from seed, so we'll have a little more control over it this year. But once, what I love about it is once you introduce them, they will keep coming up in various places. So the anise hyssop, and I would, it's not that hard to find the seeds. Here's what they, I'm reading from The Herb Farm Cookbook by Jerry Trownfield, which I have used before. It's a great compilation of it's from this chef in somewhere in the northwest, and he has a restaurant, and outside of the restaurant, he has a huge herbal garden, and he grows so many kinds of herbs. And you know, the trick is he runs out and apparently picks it and puts it on your plate. And it's, you know, anyway. So what he says about anise hyssop is you use the leaves and the flowers, and it has a flavor characteristic. It's in the mint family. So he says it's a little minty, but predominantly it's a sweet anise. And it goes well with peaches, nectarines, berries, apricots, and melons. And so he says, this is from Jerry Trownfield, even if anise hyssop were odorless and inedible, it would be worth growing just for its maroon-tinged, spear-shaped leaves and its stunning spikes of feathery, vivid purple-blue blossoms. But it smells like heaven and tastes like candy.
Ah,
so it's wonderful with all these fruits that we're going to be having, among other things. I've also made it... it goes well with ginger, too, and kind of Asian-y things. Uh-huh. Like a sorbet I made one year was just an infusion of anise hyssop tea and some ginger juice. Or maybe I grated it into the tea water, and then I strained it, then I added sugar, and it made a wonderful, very light summer sorbet. So anise hyssop is one of the things I'm getting really, really excited about.
Anise hyssop is one of the things that I like to gather things and try them. And I'm enjoying things that I've dried last summer as a tea. I have an herb tea.
Oh, right. She makes a great flavored herbal tea.
It's just kind of all in one big pot. And anise hyssop is one of those things that's really nice to mix with everything else. And like that,
it would be a real dominant flavor.
Very good. It is.
So, and this is a very self-serving question, because I'm always dying to know what Lana has planted that's new this year, because I'll get to try it. So what do we got in the surprise this year?
Okay. Last year I was given some of these and I tried it. I'm going to try my hand at green shishito chili peppers, which seems to be kind of all the rage as according to all the seed catalogs. Shishito peppers, they're a sweet pepper. Think of them as kind of the cherry tomato of the pepper, pepper
family. They're small, like a jalapeno, but yeah, really
mild,
hardly any heat. Yeah.
No, sweet.
Yeah.
They're small and green and kind of a little bit wrinkly. The little long pepper, a lot happens.
Yeah, you can throw a bunch of them onto the grill. They're really good grilled.
Mm-hmm. They're a relatively mild. It's a Japanese variety that is becoming really popular all over. And it earns its name from shishi, the Japanese word for lions. So think of them as lion peppers. And here's the thing. We have a friend named Paula. Paula is spent a lot of time in Catalonia.
Yeah, she's from Barcelona.
Barcelona. But she has these wonderful food stories, and we ran into some last year. We were eating some shishito peppers, and she's, oh, we've had these for years. They're part of the Spanish tapas tradition. And the idea, it's a drinking game, because one nice thing about shishito peppers is that they're mild, except, and you can find this in the seed catalogs too, because they say 1 out of 10, or maybe 1 out of 12 of these peppers are slightly hot. So the idea is, eat shishito peppers. And the first person to bite into a hot one and cringes, because yes, your face will cringe up a little bit, you have to buy the next round if you get a hot pepper.
The next round of drinks are on the person who gets the hot pepper.
Oh. So I think this is a fine thing to add to my garden. I am looking forward to green shishito peppers. Yeah, we'll see how this works. I've got some in the ground. Not in the ground. I've got some in my greenhouse now. We'll see how they do. Also, there's lots of varieties of plants that we just barely scratched the surface of. I mean, we grow lots of things in our gardens, but there are native plants, and there are so many plants that we don't know about. This is a bit of audio from the Donalana Kitchen Archives. Many years ago, we talked about a plant called Apios americana. Let's listen to this longtime archive audio.
Today, our guest in the kitchen is Stephen Cannon. He's a biologist with the USDA, and he's also a local urban gardener here in Ames, and he has lots of good advice. So welcome to the Donalana Kitchen, Stephen.
Thanks for the invitation.
Well, first of all, how did you get interested in this, what is now rather obscure bit of botany?
So what I do with the USDA Agricultural Research Service is work on a lot of different crop legumes. Soybean is the main one we'd recognize around here. A bunch of other species, some familiar, some not so familiar. Familiar ones would be, say, chickpea, common bean, peanut. A little less familiar would be fava bean or pigeon pea. And Apios is of interest because it's in the same plant group, and it's native in this area. It was actually used by Native Americans really through the eastern half of North America. So I couldn't really not study this one too.
It's a little bit confusing because you are a bean specialist, but Apios grows under the ground. So
okay, so if you were just to come across it, let's say walking along a riverbank, that's its kind of common habitat around here, you would probably first think that it was a wisteria or maybe a common bean. It has it vines, crawls up other riverbank vegetation. If you were to come across it in the fall, it has a really pretty kind of pink, slightly brownish, just sort of dark pink cluster of flowers, a little bit like a cluster of wisteria or a cluster of grapes.
Oh, is it that big?
It's a big flower.
Oh, I have a picture, but I can't quite get the scale in it. They do look quite beautiful. Would you want them in your garden?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, it does have a pretty flower. And if you were to find it later in the fall, you would see beans just like a string bean. Mm. And in fact, you can eat those, but the pods are a bit tough and the seeds are a bit small. So the way Native Americans used it was to dig under the ground. And underground, it has a tuber very much like a small potato.
So it is a tuber then, the part that you eat?
It is.
So you're eating the tuber, not really, strictly speaking, the bean.
That's correct.
Ah, now it's making a little more sense to me.
And according to the source that I'm looking at here, it's not just one tuber. They're kind of in a necklace. There's one after another. Is that common?
More than
one little lump underneath the ground?
So anatomically, this is very much like a potato. Mm-hmm. That is, the potato will fruit above ground. And if you've ever seen a potato plant sort of late in the season, it has kind of little berries, which you don't want to eat because they're poison.
But, all potatoes?
But of course, yeah. But underground, of course, the potato has these tubers. And those tubers actually form on underground stems. So botanically, they're called stolons. Apios is just the same way. So some of the plant stems climb above ground, and some dive and form these tubers every few inches. So it's different in potato than potato in that potato forms one tuber at the end of its stolons, and apios forms basically a tuber every 3 or 4 inches.
So one plant would have, what, a handful or 10 or 2?
It depends a bit on the variety. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that we're looking at genetically is the variety of tuber shapes and sizes and numbers underground.
And were they in the wild, there were multiple varieties?
Yeah, so just like in most plant species that you'd find in the wild, there's a lot of diversity. The wild range of apios extends from southern North America, let's say Louisiana, Florida, up into Canada, Nova Scotia, Quebec.
And the eastern part of the United States, including Iowa.
Including Iowa,
That's very good.
Well, and let's talk about the important part, eating them.
Yeah, what did these things taste like?
Well, to me, they taste a lot like a russet potato. That is, like a potato, but a bit on the drier side. The texture is a little bit finer.
They reminded me a little bit of yucca in that way.
Yeah, yeah.
They look like potatoes, though.
Depending on the age of the tuber, mm-hmm. And how they're prepared, they can be a little bit fibrous, like the South American yucca.
Mm-hmm.
When you harvest them younger, they're a little bit more like a young potato, you know, finer grained.
And the little ones looked a lot like new potatoes kind mm-hmm. of thing.
One important nutritional difference is that they're much higher protein content than potato.
So this made them an important early food, foraged food.
That's right.
Were they actually cultivated, or do we know?
You know, it's hard to know, but there are some hints that they were cultivated, and it's actually cultivated. I think they must have been carried around from campsite to campsite. One indication of that is that there are populations of sterile triploid apios plants. That is, there's something about the chromosomes of some varieties of apios such that they are sterile.
How would that happen in the wild?
Botanically, it's a little complicated, but it happens. For example, watermelon is triploid.
Ah.
At least some varieties of watermelon.
Seedless watermelon. Right. Yeah. But that was a breeding thing we did on purpose, right?
Well, it can also happen spontaneously.
Oh, interesting.
Okay.
So the interesting clue about cultivation of Apios is that this triploid sterile clone extends through much of New England. Well, how would it have been? How would it become spread across several states in New England if it weren't carried?
Oh, that's right. Okay, so instead of propagation happening through the flower, for the beans on the top, mm-hmm. the propagation would happen by tubers because you can plant just like a potato.
Exactly. And,
oh, so the tubers weren't sterile, only the beans on the top?
That's correct. That's right.
So and that's how we plant potatoes.
Well, I was just wondering. Yeah. I thought in nature, which is the survival of the fittest, why would it be producing something sterile? But as long as that's not really sterile. Like yeah. you can't plant a watermelon, a seedless watermelon, and grow watermelons.
That's true. That's true. And so the term ground nut, peanuts are also called ground nuts sometimes. They used to be. But it has nothing to do with a peanut.
Well, it has a little bit to do with the peanut in that they're the same plant family. But their common ancestor existed probably 55 million years ago.
Oh, they are related. Because that sweetened Apios that you made last night mm-hmm. Has, like if you do a boiled peanut soup and mush it enough, it kind of had that richness of the sweetened one that you made last night. And I felt like, at least culinarily speaking, there was a similarity there.
Yeah, I've heard other people say it has a bit of a similarity to boiled peanut.
Mm-hmm. Oh, talk about the dish that you tasted last night.
Well, Steve brought two things. And one was, those were the larger Apios, right? And they were sliced and boiled, am I correct, with a little sugar?
Yeah, so I simply sliced these, boiled them.
Those were peeled, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
And when they were softened from the boiling, then I put them in a pan with a little bit of honey
butter.
Yeah.
And they were delicious. And then he also made this wonderful savory dish with the smaller ones left unpeeled, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did you roast those first, or those were also boiled and then put in? Tell us about that dish as well.
So I boiled those, and then I added those to a little bit of...
they're about, an inch average round, more or less.
Yeah. Then I added them to some lightly sautéed garlic and added some red pepper, sweet red pepper, and some herbs, oregano, parsley, chive blossoms, salt and pepper.
Did you have another starch in there?
No, that was it.
It was very good.
So I'll pass along as well two Indian recipes I've read about but haven't tried, although these would be a little similar, the two recipes that I just mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
So one of these is boiling them and then cooking them in raccoon fat. I don't have raccoon fat at hand, but...
Lana has raccoons, so we could perhaps harvest you some, and I bet hers are fat.
Well, there you go.
That's it? Well, actually, who knows?
Raccoon fat,
And so I suppose the similarity to the savory dish that we tried yesterday, the fat in that savory dish was butter and olive oil. Olive oil I hadn't mentioned before, but those two mm-hmm. things. And then Indians also used a sweet Apios that they prepared with maple syrup.
Mm. It's amazing that here's this plant growing under the ground and edible, and people used to eat it, and we're just rediscovering it. And I want to thank you, Stephen, for making this, drawing it to our attention.
Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. Thank you for Stephen Cannon for sharing information about Apios americana, also called the groundnut. Yes, it is. This is the Donalana Kitchen, and you're listening to KHOI Community Radio. Find out more at khoifm.org and support this fine radio station. Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. We've been talking about spring things and St. Patrick's
Rice
Day
Krispies.
And gardens. And let's talk about, well, it sounds sort of like it shouldn't happen. It sounds like kind of a strange conjunction of words, but Donna, Iowa shrimp. Talk about Iowa shrimp.
Okay. So this is happening in Story City, right? An enterprising young fellow. I think it must be in the, you know, that, it used to be an antique mall, maybe on the eastern side of town or something. So he's gone into that space and he's built this giant tank and he is growing, shrimp in a system he calls, it's an algae based recirculating aquaculture system.
Oh, good for him.
So he is growing shrimp in Iowa. Now, we don't know much about it yet because we haven't tasted it.
Well, we haven't visited. We should
But apparently you have to be in a waiting list to buy them. So he's working up the production. He sells the whole shrimp, none of this peeled and deveined stuff. I am looking forward to tasting them because he is using he's using algae to treat the wastewater, which he claims makes the cleanest water. In addition to that, he doesn't have to discharge any wastewater into the environment. So it's called the Midland Company.
His name is Jackson Kimmel. Or Kimley,
maybe.
Okay. Anyway, good for him.
Yeah. So we will, as we learn more about this, we will keep you all informed about Iowa shrimp.
It's not an oxymoron. It is true. It is true. And we can be
it's not an April Fool's joke either.
No, it is not. It is not. I'm looking for I like shrimp.
I think we can't call it seafood anymore, though. That's not a fair moniker.
It isn't.
No.
Oh, but, well, I don't care as long as it tastes good.
We'll see how it tastes.
We'll see how it tastes. We are looking forward to it. Iowa shrimp. Oh, back to seeds. I want to mention that nasturtiums, which Don and I really like, nasturtiums, the flower. You can eat both the flower and the leaves, and they taste very radishy. Radishy.
Right. With a little bit of heat. If you put some nasturtium leaves into the salad, it's a really, really nice treat. And, of course, the flowers make a lovely, lovely garnish.
Right.
So we're going to – I bought five varieties this year.
Oh, do tell.
Right. Something called the Alaskan mix, which looks like the traditional kind of orange is traditional, right? Mm-hmm. And then this other one called the orchid cream, which is described as resembles an intricately painted orchid. Whoa. So they're kind of look like mellow cream colored with a variegated purple throughout them, really pretty. Then something called the King Theodore, which is a mahogany red with chocolate overtones on compact dark green plants.
Ha.
Very, very stunning. And then the tall trailing mix. So nasturtiums can, you know, be grown in the ground. They're also wonderful in planters, of which I have a few around in my landscaping. So this is a trailing one that should go over the sides of the planters and be beautiful. And then a third one called a cherry rose jewel. So you can imagine what that was going to be.
So just dreams of summer gardens.
Color.
And here's a note about nasturtiums. Do not run out and plant these seeds now. These are a heat-loving plant. And the seeds are...
They're big.
They're big and they're hard. They're little hard balls. And they may take a while to come up, but in a warm soil with the kind of loving care that I'm sure you will give them, they will come up. So wait until all danger of frost is past, like late April or even later, because they won't do a thing until it's warm outside.
Well, and the other thing I do before I plant them, it says you can nick seeds, which I think would be impossible, or you can soak them. So I just empty the seed packet into a little teacup of water and I soak them overnight before I plant them.
Yes, that does help. It helps a lot, especially for those big hard seeds. The nicking of seeds, it's kind of breaking up the seed coat.
I'm trying to think, what do? Put it between my teeth and take a little crunch?
Well, you do that, but don't do that. Here is a trick. You get a little piece of sandpaper and put the seeds in there, fold the sandpaper over it and go rub, 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 rub. So they roll around on the sandpaper a little bit. That works as opposed to trying to nick each seed.
Have you done that with nasturtiums?
Yep.
Do you think that's more effective than soaking?
I think soaking is better, but then
soaking is really easy.
It's easier. There you go.
We go for easy.
Oh, good. We've been talking about good stuff today, and I'm just all ready for sunshine and gaudy and tasty nasturtiums. Donna, mention that recipe book again and the herb.
The St. Patrick's Day special for all things Irish and cooking. And really, she's good. You don't have to wait for St. Patrick's Day. She's just a gem of a cookbook writer. The Dorina Allen and this book is called Forgotten Skills of Cooking. I think she has probably other ones like the Ballymallow Cookbook or something like that. But the books are beautiful. Her recipe writing is brilliant. It's fun and it's very clear. So that's Dorina, Darina Allen, Allen, for all things Irish and food.
Good. And the Herb Farm Cookbook.
Oh yeah, the Herb Farm Cookbook. If you're thinking about your gardening, the Herb Farm Cookbook, Jerry Traunfeld, Traunfeld, Traunfeld. Both of these are not new cookbooks. You might even be able to pick up a used copy easily on the internet or something like that.
Yeah, that Herb Farm, I found out a lot of stuff. When I started working on this Donna Lana Kitchen Show project, Donna would mention these strange herbs, and that's a good place to find out about them. Not just how to grow them, but what in the heck to do with them in the kitchen.
Well, and I want to say the Dorina Allen Cookbook uses a lot of, she has multiple rose geranium recipes, which you do not see very often. So apparently rose geraniums are quite available in Ireland.
Great, great. Well, three cheers. There's something to celebrate here. The Ames Public Library is opening again.
Yahoo!
And it's opening again cautiously. Be careful. Wear your mask and all that kind of stuff. There's a new bookstore opening in downtown Ames. So, folks, keep up the good work. Wear a mask. Wash your hands. Be kind. Get a shot when you can. And three cheers again. Deb Holland is our Secretary of the Interior. Oh boy.
Finally, we will have a Native American perspective on on an issue that we have long needed to think about.
You know, I've been kind of watching her career. I look at her pictures of her and hear her speak and I think, she could do okay.
Yeah, so. I think that the natives of this continent perhaps will bring some wisdom to the way we manage our lands, our public lands.
Yes, yes, yes. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. Find us here live at noon on Tuesdays, repeated at 7 p.m. Support this fine radio station. We had music today by the Barn Owl Band. We heard a poem by W.B. Yeats. We had We had the Julia Delaney played. That's a wonderful reel. And Behind the Haystack. And we'll go out with Banish Misfortune, which is a fine way to end any show. My name is Lana Noctical.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We had excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.